though it wasn't on their list. Henry figured they would be there a while, and Mrs. Beatty's backhanded wave, dismissing him to the rear step of the mess hall, all but confirmed it. Henry traced the dirt road to the nearest gate and followed the path between the two barbed wire fences. This no-man's land was actually a modestly trafficked walkway, leading a few hundred yards to a latticed area designated for visitation with the prisoners, as they called themselves, or evacuees, as the army made a habit of calling them. The path led to a seating area along the interior fence line, where a small procession of visitors came and went, chatting and sometimes crying as they held hands through the barbed wire separating the prisoners from those on the outside. A pair of soldiers in uniform sat at a makeshift desk on the prisoners' side, their rifles leaning against the fence post. They looked as bored as could be, playing cards, stopping occasionally to inspect letters that were being handed out or whatever care packages were being delivered. Because he'd been working inside the camp, Henry could have walked right up to the soldiers at the desk from the mess hall, but the fear of straying too far and being mistaken for a resident of Camp Harmony was very real. That was why Mrs. Beatty had him hang out behind the mess hall, either on the steps where the kitchen workers knew who he was, or in her truck when they were preparing to leave. Even with his special access, it seemed safer to go about visiting the camp's residents the proper way, if only to keep Mrs. Beatty happy so she'd continue bringing him with her. Henry stood at the fence, tapping the wire with a stick, unsure if it was electrified. He was certain it wasn't, but was wary nonetheless. To his surprise, the soldiers didn't even seem to notice him there. Then again, they were busy arguing with a pair of women from a local Baptist church who were trying to deliver a Japanese Bible to an elderly internee, a woman who looked ancient to Henry. "Nothing printed in Japanese is allowed," one of the soldiers argued. The women showed him their crosses and tried to hand the young soldiers pamphlets of some kind. They refused. "If I can't read it in God's plain English, it ain't coming into the camp," Henry overheard one of the soldiers say. The women said something to the Japanese lady in her native tongue. Then they touched hands and waved their goodbyes. The Bible left the camp the way it came, and the old woman retreated empty-handed. The soldiers went back to their card game. Henry watched and waited until he saw a beautiful slip of a girl walk up the muddy path in a faded yellow dress, red galoshes covered in mud, and a brown raincoat. She stood on the other side of the fence, her smiling face, pale from food poisoning, framed by cold metal and sharp wire. A captured butterfly. Henry smiled and exhaled slowly.
"I had a dream about you last week," Keiko said, looking relieved but happy and even a little confused. "I keep thinking, this must still be a dream."
Henry looked along the fence, then back at Keiko, touching the metal points between them.
"This is real. I'd rather have the dream, too." "It was a nice dream. Oscar Holden was playing, and we were dancing."
"I don't know how to dance," Henry protested.
"You knew how to dance in my dream. We were dancing in some club, with all kinds of people. And the music? It was the song he played for us. The song from the record we bought. But it was slower somehow. We were slower." "That's a nice dream."
Henry felt it as much as she did.
"I think about that dream. I think about it so much. I dream it during the day, while I'm walking around the dirty camp, walking back and forth to the infirmary to help the old people and the sick with my mom. I dream it all the time, not just at night."
Henry rested his hands on the barbed wire fence.
"Maybe I'll dream it too." "You don't have to, Henry. In here, I think my dream is big enough for the both of us.
Henry looked up at the nearby guard tower, with its menacing machine guns and sandbags to protect them. Protect them from what?
I'm sorry you're here, he said. I didn't know what else to do after you left. So I just came here, trying to find you. I still don't know what to do. There is something you can do.
Keiko touched the fence too, her hands on top of Henry's.
Can you bring us a few things? I don't have any paper or envelopes, no stamps either. But if you bring me some, I'll write to you. And could you bring us some fabric? Any kind, just a few yards. We don't have any curtains, and the searchlights shine through our windows and keep us up at night. Anything. I'll do it. And I have a special request.
Henry traced his thumbs over the backs of her soft hands, looking into her chestnut-brown eyes through the jagged coils of fence.
It's my birthday next week. Could you bring all that stuff back by then? We're going to have a record concert outside that day, right after dinner. Our neighbor traded with the soldiers for a record player, but they only have a scratchy grand old Opry recording, something like that, and it's terrible. The soldiers are going to let us have a record concert, outdoors, if the weather clears up. They might even play the music for us through the loudspeakers, and I'd really like to have a visit on my birthday. We can sit right here and listen. What day is your birthday? He asked.
Henry knew she was a few months older than he was, but had completely forgotten her birthday in the confusion of recent events.
It's actually a week from tomorrow, but we're trying to have our first camp social, something to make this more of a camp and less of a prison. Next Saturday is the day they propose for the record concert, so we'll just celebrate it then.
Do you have the record we bought? Henry asked. Keiko shook her head, biting her lip.
Where is it?
Henry asked, remembering the empty streets of Neomachi, the rows of boarded-up buildings.
It's probably in the basement of the Panama Hotel. There's a lot of stuff there. It's where Dad put some of the things we couldn't fit in our suitcases. Things we didn't want to sell either. Personal things. But it was being boarded up as we left. I'm sure it's shuttered now. You'll never get in. And if you do, I don't know if you could ever find it. There's so much.
Henry thought about the old hotel. The last he recalled, the ground floor had been boarded up completely. The windows on the upper floors, the ones left uncovered, had all been broken by rocks thrown by kids below in the days since the evacuation.
That's okay. I'll get what I can, and bring it back next Saturday. Same time? Later. Next week we're back here in Area 4, helping with dinner. But I can meet you here afterward, around 6. I'll probably see you at dinner if you come through my line. I'll be here. Where am I going to go?
She looked around, eyeing the long stretch of barbed wire, then glanced down, seemingly noticing how muddy she was. Then she reached in her pocket.
I have something for you.
Henry reluctantly let go of her other hand as she pulled out a small bundle of dandelions tied with a ribbon.
These grow between the floorboards of our house. Not really a floor, just wooden planks spread out on the dirt. My mom thought it was horrible to have all these weeds growing at our feet. But I like them. They're the only flowers that grow here. I picked them for you.
She handed them to Henry through a gap beneath the wire.
I'm sorry,
Henry said. He suddenly felt foolish having come empty-handed.
I didn't bring you anything. That's okay. It's enough that you came. I knew you would. Maybe it was my dream. Maybe I was just wishing it. But I knew you'd find me.
Keiko looked at Henry, then took a deep breath.
Does your family know you're here? She asked.
They don't know, Henry confessed, ashamed of his mother's ambivalence and his father's joyfulness.
I'm sorry I didn't tell them. I couldn't. They never let me come. I hate my father. He's...
That's okay, Henry. It doesn't matter.
It's okay.
I wouldn't want my son coming to a prison camp either.
Henry turned his hands upward, feeling Keiko rest hers in his, as they both felt the sharp metal of the wire sway between them, unyielding. Looking down, he noticed there was dried mud beneath her fingernails. She saw it too, curling her fingers in, then looking up to meet Henry's eyes. The moment, for what it was, ended abruptly as Henry heard honking in the distance. It was Mrs. Beatty in her truck, waving him back. Evidently, she suspected where she might find him.
I have to go. I'll be back next week, okay?
Henry said. Keiko nodded, swallowing her tears but finding a smile.
I'll be here.
Home Again, 1942. Henry woke up Sunday morning feeling like a new man, even if he was only 12, going on 13, actually.
He'd found Keiko. He'd seen her face to face. And somehow, just knowing where she was became a comfort, even if that place was a mud-soaked prison camp. Now all he had to do was find a few items to bring back to Camp Harmony by next Saturday. But what about the Oscar Holden record? That'd be a nice birthday gift, he thought, if he could find it. In the kitchen, Henry found his father, still in his robe, poring over a map of China from a National Geographic magazine he used to keep track of the war. His father had pasted it to a corkboard with small sewing pins stuck here and there to indicate major battles, blue for victories and red for defeats. There were several new blue pins. Still, Father was shaking his head.
Good morning, Henry said.
Jōsan, Henry's father replied, tapping a spot on the map with his worn fingernail. He kept muttering a phrase in Cantonese that Henry didn't understand. Samjang dang, over and over again.
What does that mean? Henry asked.
It sounded like three lights. He and his father had settled into a pattern of non-communication months ago. Henry knew when his father was lamenting something, all he had to do was ask a question. Even if it were in English, if the tone sounded like a question, Henry would get an explanation of some kind.
It means three tiny lights. It's a joke, Father said in Cantonese. The Japanese call it three fires. They call it kill all, burn all, loot all. They closed the Burma Road. But since the bombings at Pearl Harbor, we're finally getting supplies from the Americans.
Aren't you an American? Henry thought. Aren't we Americans? Aren't they getting supplies from us? Henry's father kept talking, whether to himself or his son, Henry couldn't be sure.
Not just supplies, planes. The Flying Tigers are helping Chiang Kai-shek and the Nationalist Army defeat the Japanese Imperial invaders. But they're destroying everything now. The Japanese are killing civilians, torturing thousands, burning cities.
Henry saw the conflict in his father's eyes, in how he stared at the map, happy and sad, victorious and defeated.
There's good news for us, though. Hong Kong is secure. The Japanese have been contained in the north for months. Next school year, you can go to Canton.
He said it like it was a birthday. Christmas and Chinese New Year's all rolled into one. Like this would be welcome news. His father had spent most of his school years in China, finishing his education, an expected rite of passage. Sending their children to stay with relatives to attend Chinese school was what most families, traditional Chinese families like Henry's, did.
What about my scholarship to Rainier? What about just going to the Chinese school on King Street, like the other kids? What if I don't want to go?
Henry said the words, knowing his father would understand only a few. Scholarship, Rainier, King Street.
Huh?
His father asked.
No, no, no. Back to Canton.
The thought of going to China was terrifying. It was a foreign country to Henry, one without jazz music or comic books. Or Keiko. He envisioned staying at his uncle's house, which was probably more of a shack, and being teased by the locals for not being Chinese enough. The opposite of here, where he wasn't American enough. He didn't know which was worse. It made Keiko's situation, while bleak, seem so much more appealing. Henry caught himself feeling a twinge of jealousy. At least she was with her family. For now, anyway. At least they understood. At least they wouldn't send her away. Before Henry could press his bilingual argument, his mother appeared from the kitchen and handed him a shopping list and a few dollars. She often sent him to the market when there was only a little buying to be done, especially since Henry seemed to have a knack for negotiating bargains. He took the note and a steamed pork bow for breakfast on the way and headed down the stairs and out into the cold morning air, relieved to get away for a while. Walking down South King towards 7th Avenue and the Chinese marketplace, Henry thought of what to get Keiko for her birthday, aside from paper for writing, fabric for curtains, and the Oscar Holden record, which he was bound and determined to find. The first two items would be easy. He could pick up stationery and fabric at Woolworth's on 3rd Avenue any time during the week, and he knew where the record was. But what would she want for a birthday present? What could he buy that would make a difference in the camp? He'd saved all his money from working with Mrs. Beatty. What could he buy? Maybe a new sketchbook or a set of watercolors. Yes, the more he thought about it, art supplies would be perfect. How he'd actually get the record, though, that question remained unanswered as he walked past the marketplace and into Nihonmachi. Two blocks over on South Main, he stood before the boarded-up facade of the Panama Hotel. There was no way in. It would take a crowbar and more muscle than rested on Henry's small shoulders. And once he made his way in, where would it be? He had the money. Why not buy a new one? That made more sense than trying to break his way into the old hotel. But that, too, seemed fruitless as he walked from Nihonmachi toward downtown and the Rhodes department store. He had doubts about whether they'd sell it to him, especially after all the trouble he and Keiko had gone through the first time. Those doubts were magnified when he walked past the Admiral Theater. The marquee featured a new movie called Little Tokyo, USA, which piqued his curiosity yet made Henry wary and nervous. The publicity photos were of big Hollywood stars, Harold Huber and June Dupre, made up to look Japanese. They were playing spies and conspirators who'd helped plot the bombing of Pearl Harbor. Judging from all the torn ticket stubs and cigarette butts that dotted the damp sidewalk, the movie was a hit. Rhodes was out of the question. Henry wasn't trusted in these parts of town, and the Black Elks Club was still closed down. No hope of going to the source, Oscar Holden himself, to buy a new record. Henry kicked a can on the sidewalk. His stomach knotted in frustration. Maybe Sheldon. Henry zigzagged back in the direction of South Jackson, where Sheldon sometimes played on Sunday afternoons, usually when there was a new ship in town, bringing restless sailors and their dates to the neighborhood. His walk back took him past the Panama Hotel again. The massive marble entrance that he was never allowed to enter was now boarded up. Henry looked at the shopping list his mother had given him. He probably had another 30 minutes before his parents would worry about him being late. Thinking there must be a back way in, Henry slipped down the alley, behind the vacant and boarded-up Togo Employment Agency. The alley itself was piled with boxes and heaps of garbage, stacks of clothing and old shoes. Belongings that no one wanted, thrown out, but still here since the garbage service to this area had evidently been suspended. Behind the hotel,
Henry looked for a freight entrance or a fire escape he could shimmy up to one of the many broken windows on the second floor. Instead, he found Chaz, Will Whitworth, and a small gathering of other boys trying to gain entrance too. They were looking and pointing at the second-story windows, some threw rocks, while others pawed through the boxes left behind. One boy Henry didn't recognize had found a box of dishes and began throwing them against a brick wall, shattering them, pieces of fine porcelain china raining down. Before Henry could yell or run or hide, they saw him. One, then all of them.
"It's a Jap!" one of the boys yelled. "Get him!"
"No, it's a chink," Will said, stopping the boy for a moment as they all stalked in Henry's direction. Chaz took control of the situation.
"Henry!"
Smiling, he seemed more happy than surprised.
"Where's your girlfriend, Henry? She's not home if you're looking for her. And your nigger friend ain't around today, is he?"
he taunted. "Better get used to me. My dad's gonna buy all these buildings, so we might end up neighbors." Henry's knees felt wobbly, but his jaw was clenched tighter than his fists. On a pile of garbage lay an old broom handle, almost as tall as Henry. He picked it up with both hands and gripped it like a baseball bat. He swung it once, then twice for good measure. It felt light and sturdy, sturdy enough to hit a curveball the size of Chaz's head. All of the boys stopped, except for Chaz, who inched closer to Henry, staying just out of range of his makeshift club.
"Go home, Chaz."
The anger in his voice surprised Henry. He felt the blood drain away from his fists, where they clenched the broom handle, until his knuckles turned pale. Chaz spoke softly, a mock gentleness to his voice.
"This is my home. This is the United States of America, not the United States of Tokyo. And my dad is probably going to end up owning this whole neighborhood anyway. What are you going to do? Take us all on? You think you can beat us all up?"
Henry knew he didn't stand a chance against all seven of them.
"You might get to me eventually, but I know one of you will be going home with a limp."
Henry swung the club, smacking it on the dirty, gritty pavement between him and the larger boy. He vividly remembered the bruised cheek and black eye he'd received outside the train station, courtesy of Chaz. The boys in the back hesitated. Retreating, they dropped the items they'd pilfered from the alley, then turned and fled around the corner. Henry swung fiercely at Chaz, who backed up too, looking pale and even a little scared. The spiked hair of his crew cut seemed to wilt. Without a word, Chaz spit on the ground between them and then walked away. Henry held on to the broom handle, resting it on the pavement, his whole body shaking and his heart pounding. His legs felt limp.
"I did it. I beat them. I stood up to them. I won."
Henry turned around and walked face first into a soldier, actually two soldiers, with Army MP bands on their arms. Their rifles were slung across their shoulders, and each had a long black baton dangling from a short leather strap attached to his wrist. One of the soldiers looked down, poking Henry's chest with his baton, tapping his button. Henry dropped the broom handle, which made a wooden clattering sound on the pavement.
"No more looting, kid. I don't care who you are. Beat it."
Henry backed up, then walked away as fast as his wobbly legs would carry him. Out on South Main, he hustled in the direction of Jackson, Sheldon's neighborhood. He saw the lights of a police car, reflected in the wet pavement and the puddles he tried to avoid. Looking back, he saw Chaz and his friends sitting on the sidewalk being questioned by a police officer, who had a notepad out and was busy writing something. It looked like the officer wasn't buying whatever excuse Chaz was stringing along. There had been too much vandalism and looting. And now, he'd been caught in the act.
Dinner, 1986. Much to Henry's surprise, Samantha was an incredible cook. Henry had a special affinity for anyone with talent in the kitchen, since he himself did most of the cooking in his own home. Even before Ethel fell ill,
he had liked to cook. But after the cancer hit, all of the cooking and the cleaning, the washing, everything fell to Henry. He didn't mind. She was in such pain, always sick, always suffering from the cancer or the radiation treatments that were designed to kill parts of her insides. Both ravaged her small, frail body. The least Henry could do was cook her favorite pan-fried noodles or make her fresh mango custard with mint. Even though near the end, as wonderful as it sounded, she'd had little appetite. It was all Henry could do to get her to drink fluids. And at the very end, she really just wanted to go, needed to go.
He thought of that and fought off a wave of melancholy as his son offered a toast, raising his teacup of Yu Jiao, a fermented wine that tasted more like grain alcohol.
To a successful find in the basement time capsule of the Panama Hotel.
Henry raised his glass, but followed up with only a sip, as Marty and Samantha downed their cups, wincing and grimacing at the strong, eye-watering taste.
"Geez, that burns," Marty groaned.
Smiling, Henry filled his son's cup again with the clear, innocent-looking liquid that could just as easily be used to strip the grease from used car parts.
"To Oscar Holden and long-lost recordings," Samantha toasted.
"No, no, no, I'm done. I know my limit," Marty said, lowering her arm, grounding it once again to the round table in the corner of the small dining room that also functioned as Henry's living room.
It was a quiet, reflective place, alive with potted plants, like the jade plant that Henry had nurtured since Marty was born. The walls were covered with family photos, colorful and bright against the once white surface that now looked tarnished and yellow, darkened in the corners like coffee-stained teeth. Henry looked at his son and the young woman he was obviously enchanted with, holding their cups, feeling the burn, how different they were. And how little it mattered. Their differences were unnoticeable. So alike, and so happy. Hard to tell where one person ended and the other began. Marty was happy, successful, good grades, and happy. What more could any father want for his son? And as Henry looked at the vast pile of crab shells and the empty platter of choi sum, he realized Samantha's cooking rivaled that of Ethel's in her heyday, even his own cooking. Marty had chosen well.
"Okay, who's ready for dessert?"
"I'm so full," Marty groaned, pushing his plate away.
"There's always room," Henry taunted as Samantha stepped into the kitchen and returned, bringing out a small platter.
"What's this?" Henry asked, stunned. He'd expected green tea ice cream.
"I made this especially for my future father-in-law. The ice cream's for me. But this," she set a plate of delicately spun white candies in front of Henry, "this is something for a special occasion. It's Dragon's Beard candy."
The last time Henry had had Dragon's Beard candy was long before Ethel got sick. As he bit into the thread-thin strands of sugar wrapped around a filling of grated coconut and sesame seeds, he watched Marty smile, nodding in approval, as if to say, "See, Pops? I knew you'd like her." It was delicious.
"This takes years to learn to make. How did you..."
"I've been practicing," Samantha explained. "Sometimes you have to just go for it. Try for what's hardest to accomplish. Like you and your childhood sweetheart."
Henry choked a little on his dessert, tasting the sweet filling and clearing his throat.
"I see my son's been sharing stories."
"He couldn't help it. And besides, haven't you ever wondered what happened to her? No disrespect to your wife, but this girl, whoever she may be, might still be out there somewhere. Aren't you curious where she is, where she might be?"
Henry looked at his cup of wine, then finished it in one slow pour. Biting back the sting and watery sensation it brought to his eyes, he felt his sinuses clearing as it burned. Setting the cup down, he looked at Samantha and Marty, weighing their expressions, equal parts hope and wishful thinking.
I have thought about her, Henry searched for the words, unsure of Marty's reaction, knowing how much his son loved Ethel, not wanting to trample her memory. I have thought about her. All the time. Right now, in fact. It would be wrong to tell you that, wouldn't it? But that was a long time ago. People grow up. They marry. Start families. Life goes on. Henry had thought about Keiko off and on through the years, from a longing to a quiet, somber acceptance, to sincerely wishing her the best, that she might be happy. That was when he realized that he did love her, more than what he'd felt all those years ago. He loved her enough to let her go, to not go dredging up the past. And besides, he had Ethel, who had been a loving wife. And of course he had loved her as well. And when she fell ill, he would have changed places with her if he could. To see her get up and walk again, he'd gladly have lain down in that hospice bed. But in the end, he was the one who had to keep living. When he saw those things coming up from the basement of the Panama Hotel, he had allowed himself to wonder and to wish for an Oscar Holden record no one believed existed, and for evidence of a girl who'd once loved Henry for who he was, even though he was from the other side of the neighborhood. Marty watched his father, deep in thought. You know, Pops, you have her stuff, her sketchbooks anyway. I mean, even if she's married and all, I think she'd still appreciate getting those back. And if you were the one to give them to her, what a nice coincidence that might be. I have no idea where she is, Henry protested as his son filled his cup with more wine. She might not even be alive. 40 years is a long time. And almost no one has claimed anything from the Panama. Almost no one. People didn't look back, and there was nothing to return to, so they moved on. It was true. Henry knew it. And from the look on his face, Marty knew it too. But still, no one had thought the record still existed, and it was found. Who knew what else he might find, if he looked hard enough? Steps, 1986. After dinner, Henry insisted on doing the dishes. Samantha had done a marvelous job. When Henry walked in, he half expected to find takeout boxes from the Jumbo Seafood Restaurant, hidden beneath the sink, or at least oyster sauce-stained recipe books strewn about. Instead, the kitchen was neat and tidy. She'd washed the pans as she cooked, the way Henry did. He dried and put away what few dishes remained and put some serving platters in the sink to soak. When he poked his head out to thank her, it was too late. She'd already kicked off her shoes and was asleep on the couch, snoring gently. Henry looked at the half-empty bottle of plum wine and smiled before covering her up with a green afghan Ethel had knitted. Ethel had always been crafty, but knitting had become a necessary pastime. It gave her something to do with her hands while she sat there during chemotherapy. Henry had been amazed that she could knit so well with an IV in her arm, but she didn't seem to mind. Henry felt a draft and noticed the front door was open. He could see his son's silhouette behind the screen door. Moths flitted in the porch light, pinging against the bulb, helplessly drawn to something they could never have. "Why don't you stay the night?" Henry asked, as he opened the screen door. He sat down next to Marty, waiting for an answer. "She's asleep, and it's too late to be out driving." "Says who?" Marty snapped back. Henry frowned a little. He knew his son hated it when he appeared to be bossing him around, even if the offer was genial. These were the times when he and Marty seemed to argue for the sake of arguing, and no one ever won. "I'm just saying that it's late." "Sorry, Pops," Marty said, checking his reaction. "I think I'm just tired. This year has been a rough one." He palmed an unlit cigarette. Ethel had finally succumbed to the cancer when it spread to her lungs.
Henry had quit smoking years ago, but Marty still struggled, having quit when his mother became ill, but sneaking smokes now and then. Henry knew how guilty his son felt about smoking while his mom was dying of lung cancer. Marty tossed a cigarette into the street.
I can't help thinking about Mom, and how much things have changed the last few years.
Henry nodded, looking out across the sidewalk. He could see into the front window of his neighbor's house. Their TV was on, and they were watching a Hispanic variety show of some kind. The neighborhood keeps changing, Henry thought, as he looked down the block past the Korean bakery and a dry cleaner run by a nice Armenian family.
Can I ask you something, Pops?
Henry nodded again.
Did you keep Mom at home to spite me?
Henry watched a low-ride pickup truck boom down the alleyway.
What do you think?
He asked, knowing the answer, but surprised that his son would ask such a direct question. Marty stood up and walked to the cigarette he'd tossed into the street. Henry thought he might pick up the dirty cigarette and light it. Instead, Marty stepped on it, grinding it to pieces.
I used to think that. It didn't make sense to me, you know? I mean, this isn't exactly a plush neighborhood. We could have put her someplace with a view, with a rec room.
Marty shook his head.
I think I get it now. It doesn't matter how nice home is. It just matters that it feels like home.
Henry listened to the booming truck in the distance.
Did Ye Ye know about Keiko?
Marty asked.
Did Mom know?
Henry stretched and sat back.
Your grandfather knew,
because I told him. He looked at his son, trying to gauge his reaction.
He stopped talking to me after that.
Henry had told his son little about his childhood, and stories of Marty's grandfather were seldom shared. Marty rarely asked. Most of what he knew he'd gleaned from his mother.
But what about Mom?
Henry let out a big sigh and rubbed his cheeks where he'd forgotten to shave in the commotion of the last few days. The stubble reminded him of all those months, years caring for Ethel. How days would pass without his ever leaving the house. How he'd shave for no real reason, just out of habit. Then he'd occasionally let himself go, living with someone who didn't notice, who couldn't notice.
I'm not sure what your mom knew. We didn't talk about it.
You didn't talk about old flames? Marty asked.
What old flames?
Henry laughed a little.
I was the first boy she'd ever dated. It was different back then. Not like now.
But you had one, evidently. Marty held out a sketchbook that had been sitting on the steps next to his jacket. Henry took it, flipping through the pages, touching the impressions where Keiko's pencil had danced across the paper. Feeling the texture of the drawings, he wondered why she had left her sketchbooks, why she'd left everything behind, why he had too. All these years, Henry had loved Ethel. He had been a loyal and dedicated husband, but he would walk blocks out of his way to avoid the Panama Hotel and the memory of Keiko. Had he known her belongings were still there? Henry handed the sketchbook back to his son.
You don't want it? Marty asked.
Henry shrugged his shoulders.
I have the record. That's enough.
A broken record, he thought. Two halves that will never play again.
Sheldon's Record, 1942. When Monday came, Henry was still beaming from finding Keiko and seeing Chaz hounded by the police. There was a bounce in his step as he left school and ran, walked, then ran some more, weaving around the smiling fishmongers of South King all the way over to South Jackson. People on the street seemed happy. President Roosevelt had announced that Lieutenant Colonel James Doolittle had led a squadron of B-25s on a bombing raid of Tokyo. It seemed that morale had been boosted everywhere. When asked where the planes had launched from, the president had joked, telling reporters they'd come from Shangri-La. which happened to be the name of a jazz club Henry wandered by on his way to find Sheldon. Locating him this late in the afternoon was an easy task. Henry just followed his ears, homing in on the bluesy notes coming from Sheldon's instrument, a tune Henry recognized, called Writin' Paper Blues. It was one Sheldon had played in the club with Oscar. Most appropriate, considering Henry still had to round up stationery for Keiko, among other things. Plunked down on an apartment step near where Sheldon was performing, Henry spotted a small mountain of change in the open sax case. That, and a vinyl record, a 78, propped up on a little wooden display. It was the same kind Henry's mother used in the kitchen to display what few pieces of fine china they could afford. A small hand-painted sign read, as featured on Oscar Holden's new disc record. To Henry, the crowd looked about the same. But to his pleasant surprise, they clapped with much more vigor as Sheldon played his heart out. They clapped harder as he ended on a sweet, stinging note that echoed in the clatter and din of nickels, dimes, and quarters pinging into the sax case. The mound of coins was more money than Henry had ever seen, in pocket change anyway. Sheldon tipped his hat to the last of the crowd as they dispersed.
"Henry, where you been, young sir? I haven't seen you running the streets on a weekend for 2-3 weeks now."
It was true. Henry had been so busy at Camp Harmony, and hiding that fact from his parents, that he hadn't seen Sheldon since E-Day. He felt a little guilty about his absences.
"I've picked up a weekend job. At Camp Harmony. It's that place.
I know. I know all about that place. Been in the paper now for weeks.
But how? Tell me, how on God's green earth did this bit of intrigue come about? This job?"
It was a long story, and Henry didn't even know the ending.
"Can I tell you later? I'm running errands, and I'm running late. And I need a favor."
Sheldon was fanning himself with his hat.
"Money? Take what you need,"
he said, pointing to the case filled with silvery coins. Henry tried to guess how much was in there. $20, at least, in half dollars alone. But that wasn't the flat, round object Henry needed.
"I need your record."
There was a moment of stunned silence. In the distance, Henry heard drums from a rehearsal upstairs at one of the other clubs.
"That's funny. That sounded a lot like, I need your record," Sheldon said. "It sounded a lot like, I need your last record. The only record I own, of my own playing. The only record that was left at the music store since Oscar sold them out like hotcakes just last week."
Henry looked at his friend, biting his lip.
"Is that what I heard?"
Sheldon asked, seemingly joking, but Henry wasn't entirely sure.
"It's for Keiko. For her birthday."
"Oh."
Sheldon looked like he'd been stabbed. His eyes closed and his mouth screwed up in a grimace of pain.
"You got me. You got me right here."
He patted his heart and cracked a toothy smile at Henry.
"Does this mean I can have it? I can replace it. Keiko and I bought one together. But she wasn't allowed to bring it to the camp, and now it's stored somewhere. I can't get to it. It's probably lost now."
Sheldon put his hat back on and adjusted the reed on his sax.
"You can have it, only because it's for a higher power."
Henry didn't pick up on Sheldon's jibe. Otherwise, he would have blushed horribly and denied that love was driving him in any way imaginable.
"Thank you. I'll pay you back someday," he said.
"You go play that thing. You go play that thing in that camp down there. You go. I kind of like the sound of that," Sheldon said. "It'd be the first time I ever played in a white establishment, even if it is for a bunch of Japanese folks. Bit of a captive audience."
Henry smiled and looked at Sheldon, who was obviously waiting for a reaction to this pun. Henry tucked the record under his coat and ran, yelling back,
"Thank you, sir, and you have a fine day."
Sheldon shook his head and smiled before warming up for another afternoon performance.
Henry stopped by Woolworth's on the way home from school the next day. The old five and dime was unusually crowded. Packed, in fact. Henry counted 12 different booths, each selling war bond stamps. The Elks Lodge had a booth. So did the Venture Club. Each group had a giant craft paper thermometer showing how much they'd sold, each competing to outsell the others. One even had a life-size cutout of Bing Crosby wearing an army uniform.
"Make every payday bond day,"
a man yelled as he passed out slices of pie and cups of coffee. Henry waded through the crowd, past the bright red vinyl booths and spinning stools of the soda counter, heading for the back of the store. There he gathered writing paper, art supplies, fabric, and a sketchbook, whose blank pages looked so promising, a future unwritten. He quickly paid a young woman, who simply smiled when she saw his button, then ran the rest of the way home, arriving maybe 10 minutes late. Nothing, really. Not even enough time to give his mother pause. He stashed Keiko's things with the record in an old washtub beneath the stairs in the back alley, then bounded up the steps, two at a time, light on his feet. Things were looking up, as word had already spread that Chaz and his friends had been picked up by the Seattle police for at least part of the damage they'd caused in Nihomachi. Whether they'd actually received any punishment, no one could say. The Japanese citizens, even though they were Americans, were now considered enemy aliens. Did anyone care what happened to their homes? Still, Chaz's father would probably find out soon enough that his golden boy had a heart of coal, and that was punishment enough, Henry reasoned, feeling more relief than joy. Then there was Sheldon, who was finally enjoying the monetary fruits of his musical labors. He'd always drawn a crowd, but now it was a paying crowd, not just looky-loos tossing in pennies. And along with the birthday gift, the last copy of Oscar Holden's 78 record would soon be on its way to Keiko. The song was something they could share, even if a barbed wire fence kept them apart and a machine gun tower kept watch from above. Despite the bitterness of all he'd seen and the sadness of the forced exodus to Camp Harmony, things were manageable, and the war couldn't last forever. Eventually Keiko would come home, wouldn't she? Henry whistled as he opened the door to his little apartment and saw his parents. That was when his pursed lips fell silent, and Henry lost his breath. Both of them sat at their tiny kitchen table. Spread across the table were Keiko's family albums, the ones he'd so carefully hidden beneath his dresser drawers. Hundreds of photos of Japanese families, some in traditional dress, others in military uniforms. Piles and piles of black and white images. Few of the people in them were smiling, but none looked as dour as his parents, their faces cemented in expressions of shock, shame, and betrayal. His mother muttered something in disgust, her voice cracking with emotion as she banged her way to the kitchen, shaking her head. Henry's eyes met his father's furious gaze. His father picked up a photo album, tore the spine in two, and threw it to the floor, yelling something in Cantonese. He seemed more angry at the photos themselves than at Henry. But his turn was coming. Henry knew it. Well, at least we're probably going to have a real conversation, Henry thought. And Father, it's about time. Henry set his shopping items on the table by the front door, took off his coat, and sat down in the chair opposite his father, looking down at the scattered photos of Keiko and her family, her Japanese family, her parents' wedding photos in kimonos, images of picture brides, photos of an old man, probably her grandfather, in the dress uniform of the Imperial Japanese Navy. Some Japanese families had burned these things. Other families hid their treasured memories of who they were and where they came from. Some even buried their photo albums. Buried treasure, Henry thought. It had been almost 8 months since his father had insisted he only speak English. That was about to change.
What do you have to say? Speak up! His father was snapping in Cantonese.
Before Henry could answer, his father lashed out.
I send you to school. I negotiate your way into a special school. I do this for you. A top white school. And what happens? Instead of studying, you're making eyes with this Japanese girl? Japanese! She's a daughter of the butchers of my people. Your people. Their blood is on her. She stinks of that blood.
She's American, Henry protested, speaking softly in Cantonese. The words felt strange, foreign, like stepping onto a frozen lake, unsure if it would hold your weight, or send you crashing through to the icy depths.
Look. Look with your own eyes.
Henry's father held up a page from an album, practically shoving it in Henry's face.
This is not American.
He pointed at the image of a stately man in traditional Japanese dress.
If the FBI find this here, in our home, our Chinese-American home, they can arrest us, take everything. They can throw us in jail and fine us $5,000 for helping the enemy.
She's not the enemy, Henry said, speaking a little louder, his heart racing and his hands beginning to shake, trembling with frustration, with anger he never allowed himself to feel.
You don't even know her. You've never met her.
He clenched his jaw and gritted his teeth.
I don't need to. She's Japanese. She was born in the same hospital I was born in, the same year I was born. She's an American,
Henry shouted back, so loudly it frightened even himself. He'd never spoken that way to any grown-up, let alone his own father, whom he was taught to revere and respect. His mother had walked out of the kitchen for a moment to remove a flower vase from the table. He saw her, a look of shock and disappointment on her face that Henry would ever be so disobedient. The look quickly faded to a quiet acceptance, but with it, so much guilt settled on Henry's small shoulders. He rested his head in his hands, ashamed for speaking so loudly in front of his mother. She turned away, as if he hadn't said a thing. As if he weren't there. She swept back into the kitchen before Henry could say another word. When Henry turned back, his father was already at the open window with an armload of Keiko's photos. He looked back at Henry. On his face, a blank expression that was probably a mask of his disappointment. Then he dropped the photos, the albums, and boxes. They scattered to the ground, covering the alley with white squares, lost faces staring back at no one. Henry bent down to pick up the torn album. His father snatched it from his hands and tossed it too. Henry heard the pieces hitting the pavement outside, wet, slapping sounds.
She was born here. Her family was born here. You weren't even born here.
Henry whispered to his father, who looked away oblivious to his son's words. He'd be 13 in a few months. Maybe this was what it meant to stop being a boy and start being something else, Henry thought, as he put his coat back on and headed for the door. He couldn't leave the photos outside. He turned to his father.
I'm leaving to get her photos. I told her I'd keep them for her. Just until she gets back. And I'm going to keep my promise.
His father pointed at the door.
If you walk out that door, if you walk out that door now, you are no longer part of this family. You are no longer Chinese. You are not part of us anymore. Not a part of me.
Henry didn't even hesitate. He touched the doorknob, feeling the brass cold and hard in his hand. He looked back. Speaking his best Cantonese.
I am what you made me, Father.
He opened the heavy door.
I am an American.
Camp Anyway, 1942. Henry had managed to save most of Keiko's photos. He'd wiped the mud and garbage off on his coat sleeve. And stored them in an old wash basin beneath the stairs, until he could give them to Sheldon for safekeeping. But from that moment on, he began to feel like a ghost in the little brick apartment he shared with his parents. They didn't speak to him. In fact, they barely acknowledged his presence. They'd speak to each other as if he weren't there. And when they looked his way, they'd each pretend to look right through him. He hoped they were pretending anyway. At first, he'd talk to them regardless. In English. Just table conversation. Then later, pleading in Chinese. It didn't matter. Their great wall of silence was impervious to his best attempts to subvert it. So he, too, said nothing. And since his parents' conversations often had to do with Henry's schooling, Henry's grades, Henry's future, in Henry's absence, they said very little. The only sounds heard in their tiny home came from the rustling of the daily newspaper, or the squelch and static of the wireless radio, playing news bulletins on the war and the latest local updates on rationing and drills of the Civil Air Defense. On the radio, nothing was ever mentioned of the Japanese who had been led out of Nihonmachi. It was as if they'd never existed. After a few days, his mother did acknowledge his existence, in her own way. She did his laundry and packed him a lunch, but she did it with little ceremony, presumably so as not to go against the wishes of Henry's father, who had followed up on his threat to disown him, figuratively, if not literally. "Thank you," Henry said, as his mother set out a plate and rice bowl for him. But as she reached for another set of chopsticks, "Are you expecting a guest for dinner?" Henry's father interrupted in Chinese, setting down his newspaper. "Answer me," he demanded. She looked apologetically at her husband, then quietly removed the dish, avoiding eye contact with her son. Henry, not to be discouraged completely, brought his own plate and served himself from then on, eating in all but silence, the only sounds those of chopsticks, occasionally tinging the side of his half-empty rice bowl. The deafening silence continued at Rainier Elementary, even though Henry had thought about following his old friends to the Chinese school, or even up the hill to Bailey Gatzert Elementary, which was a mixed-race school that some of the older kids went to. But then again, he knew he'd have to register somehow, and without his parents' cooperation, it seemed impossible. Maybe when the school year was over, he'd convince his mother to switch him. No, his father was too proud of his son's scholarshipping. She would never go along with it. So Henry accepted the fact that he would finish out the next 2 weeks of the sixth grade right where he was. And he had to, didn't he? Mrs. Beatty was still taking him to Camp Harmony on the weekends, and if he didn't work in the grade school kitchen all week, his weekend furloughs to see Keiko might be in jeopardy. By the time Saturday rolled around, Henry longed to talk to someone, anyone. He had tried to catch Sheldon during the week, but there was never any time before school. After school, Sheldon was always performing at the Black Elks Club, which had just reopened. When Mrs. Beatty rolled up, she seemed as good a conversationalist as Henry could hope for. She smoked while she drove, flicking her ashes out the window and blowing the smoke out the side of her mouth. It always caught the draft and billowed back in, settling on the two of them. Henry rolled his window down a few inches, trying to draw the smoke away from the presence that sat on his lap. In addition to a bag of sundries from Woolworth's, he had two boxes, each wrapped in lavender paper with white ribbon that he'd snuck from his mother's sewing box. One box contained a sketchbook, pencils, brushes, and a tin of watercolors. The other was the Oscar Holden record, the one Sheldon gave him. Henry had delicately wrapped it in tissue to keep it safe. "Little early for Christmas," Mrs. Beatty commented, flicking her butt out the window of the speeding truck.
"It's Keiko's birthday tomorrow."
"That's so," Henry nodded, waving the last of the smoke away. "Mighty thoughtful of you," Mrs. Beatty said. Just as Henry was about to speak, she interrupted. "You know they're not going to let you take those in looking like that. I mean, that could be a gun, a couple of hand grenades, who knows?
all wrapped up with a pretty bow, special delivery.
But I thought I'd just have her open them at the fence.
Don't matter, dearie. All gifts are opened by the sentry on duty.